Today, the fallout from European elections and what it all means for the Tories, for Labour and for Brexit. And the four-armed robot that can pick 25,000 raspberries a day. The reality of deepening Brexit division among British voters is starting to sink in. Nigel Farage's message, after his Brexit party topped the polls and crushed the Tories into fifth place, is get us out of the EU fast.
If we don't leave on October the 31st, then the scores you've seen for the Brexit party today will be repeated.
But others point to the Lib Dems surging past Labour, to a strong performance by pro-Remain nationalists, and the best night since 1989 for the Greens.
It is entirely legitimate to say that there is no mandate for the hard Brexit party.
And they say, give us another referendum, now. As politicians try to piece back together the shattered fragments of Britain's electoral map, voters delivered a bloody nose to establishment parties across Europe too. With a far-right surge in Italy and France, and major success for the Greens in Germany. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will the traditional parties of Britain and Europe survive this political earthquake? Daniel Boffey, you are The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief. And before that, you were in Westminster writing about British politics. Where were you when the results came in?
Along with hundreds of other journalists, I was in the cradle of European democracy, that is the European Parliament, the hemicycle, which is where the MEPs sit when they debate and vote. But they turned it into this huge TV studio with lots of flashing lights. It felt a bit like The Voice or something, or Britain's Got Talent.
So here we are on time, ladies and gentlemen.
And we sat in the MEPs' chairs, and on big flashing screens in front of us, we had all the results coming every half hour, hour or so as they as exit polls emerged. And then now and again, we'd have the old politician stand up on the stage with sort of loud music. We were able to quiz them a little bit about how well or badly they had done.
I'm not quite sure what a hemicycle is, but it sounds more like Eurovision than The Voice.
It's half a circle.
Semicircle.
Yes. Yeah, well, you could call it that. They call it a hemicycle. Yes, it was very similar to Eurovision. Nil point for Tommy Robinson.
Robinson Tommy, 38,908.
Yay! We can cheer because we're not the BBC. So tell us about the results.
So the first emerging story was a high turnout.
The first big news of the evening, that is that Europe is back.
And it seemed that we could get as high as 50%. Which might not sound huge in the context, for example, of a British general election, but for European Parliament elections, this would be a sort of 20-year high. So the question was, does this mean the populists, people are turning out for the populists, or are they turning out for the pro-European parties? And then we have the first results coming in from France, and it suggested Marine Le Pen's rebranded National Front, this is called the National Rally, looked like they're going to beat Emmanuel Macron's En Marche party, the sort of liberal party.
Très heureux, satisfait. Je pense qu'aujourd'hui Macron va essayer de réfléchir vu qu'on est passé devant.
And this was hugely symbolic because Macron had said the European Parliament's European elections were an existential thing, that it was about the forces of pro-European parties versus the ones that want to destroy Europe. And Le Pen winning, could that be a straw in the wind for a sort of wider Eurosceptic populist far-right surge? As it turned out, then we had the German election results coming in, and that wasn't the story there at all. What happened there was, yes, the centrist parties, the traditional parties collapsed, Merkel's CDU had collapsed, and the socialists, the SPD party, had a horrendous night going down to third. But it wasn't the far-right AfD that was making the gains, it was the Greens. That actually became the story over the night. The Greens doing extremely well across Europe, actually. And the populist surge, well, it was a bit of a fizzle, actually. It didn't really emerge to be the main story.
OK, so that's France and Germany. Was that mirrored across the rest of the EU?
The story across the EU was this kind of collapse of the centre, of this two parties, the European People's Party and the Socialists and Democrats, who for 40 years have kind of had a stranglehold over the levers of power in Brussels in terms of the legislation the Parliament passes, in terms of the top jobs. They've had this stranglehold, and these two parties had shrunk quite significantly, and the vote had been fragmented, and there were different winners in different countries. But that losing of the hold on the levers of power was quite significant.
Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, just 6 weeks old, has coasted to victory in the European elections, winning more British seats than any other party.
And so you're also keeping an eye on those British results coming in. The Brexit Party got 29 MEPs, the Lib Dems 16, Labour in third with 10, then the Greens on 7 before you get to the Tories with just 4. I mean, so far down the list, they didn't even get onto the BBC results board.
But in terms of the here and now, we shouldn't forget how appalling this night is for the Tories, for the governing party. This is their UKIP worst.
UKIP leader Gerard Batten lost, Tommy Robinson lost, but there was a lot of support for pro-Brexit parties. Will Brussels think the Remain vote is as significant?
We've got kind of a 50-50 split when you put them against the Brexit Party and maybe the Conservative Party and the tiny UKIP vote. And the fear that Britain is split and that this Brexit impasse, there's no way through it, was just confirmed by the results.
And what's extraordinary is the Brexit Party didn't just do incredibly well in the UK. Its 29 seats in the new European Parliament makes it the single biggest party, along with the CDU from Germany.
They were 6 percentage points higher than UKIP's take in 2014. So I think actually the European Parliament's used to having this huge kind of noisy, disruptive group of British MEPs. They're used to it, and I don't think the Brexit Party will have the ability to cause too much trouble, because the populist surge, as I said earlier, just didn't really happen in a significant enough numbers to allow the Brexit Party to be a real nuisance later on.
So, Dan, in Brussels, they talk about the European Parliament as a camembert, another hemicycle, semicircle, whatever you want to call it. And when they do infographics, they kind of place the different parties across that. And they all sit together in separate slices, whether it's the centre-right bloc or the Socialists or the Liberals or the Greens. What does the camembert look like after this election?
Well, the red bit and the blue bit, the European People's Party, the centre-right grouping, and the Socialists and Democrats, the red grouping, the on the centre-left, they have for 40 years had this stranglehold on the Parliament. They've been able to create a majority among themselves, and so that they could pass any legislation they wanted. If that has changed, they've been shrunk down. Fewer camembert pieces for them, and the Greens are up. ALDE, which is the Liberal Alliance, in which Emmanuel Macron's En Marche is going to take place, they're hugely increased to 108 seats, I think it is, from about 60-odd. And so what it means is that to get the majority in the European Parliament, so there are various sort of ways you could do it, given this new formation. But it looks most likely that what will happen is the EPP and the Socialists and Democrats will try and reach out to the Greens.
OK, so they'll be scrambling to form coalitions among pro-EU groups, which could be difficult. Could the far right take advantage of that and come together?
What is a great boon for the pro-European parties is that the Eurosceptic or far right or extremist parties, they can't work together. They squabble. They have very different policies, for example, on Russia and Putin. Does Nigel Farage and his Brexit party,
launched just 6 weeks ago,
join up with Salvini? One of the problems there is that Salvini's League, which did extremely well, I mean, you know, they got 35% of the vote on Sunday night, up from 6% 5 years ago. Do they really want to share a party with Nigel Farage's Brexit? Who would be the leader? Who'd be standing up for that party in the Parliament? The egos will clash. So that's a help to the pro-European parties that they can't get their act together on the right. But you know, if the pro-European parties don't manage to create this stable coalition, if they fall out among themselves, then yeah, there's a possibility for the far right to create nuisance, to be a pain.
What does all of this mean for who gets those big roles replacing Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker?
Today, this evening, we have the 28 heads of state and government having dinner to discuss the top jobs and who's going to be commission president, who's going to be president of the European Council, the job that Donald Tusk has. And they will be looking at whether there is a stable majority, whether the political parties have over the last 24 hours since, or 48 hours since the results, have been able to create this stable majority for any particular candidate or flavour of candidate.
And in terms of those top jobs, both the President of the European Council and the President of the European Commission, what can we expect?
Well, you see, I mean, it's very difficult because the people who claim, who could be candidates and they claim they're not candidates, might well turn out to be candidates. For example, Angela Merkel. She has been, everyone says, she's coming to the end of her time in Germany. She's going to want a top EU job. She says publicly, no, not at all. No one really believes her. They think that she's going to possibly be a candidate for maybe Commission President, maybe European Council President, more likely. Certainly, there's a big push for a female, finally, for the first time ever, to have one of these two big jobs. A good tip might be Margaret Vestager, who is the Competition Commissioner. She's the one who's been sort of pushing Google and Facebook and others, finding these big corporations, big tech corporations, for having monopolies and abusing their dominant position in the market.
Is technology really there for us as humans on our planet?
And so she's made quite a name for herself, and she's aligned with the Aldi group, with Macron's Aldi group. So maybe she's got a chance. The EPP have chosen a guy called Manfred Weber, a German MEP with very limited experience.
There is no stability, there is no stable majority without the EPP.
Who has flirted a little bit too much, perhaps, at the times with the populist right in terms of Fidesz and Viktor Orban. And Macron is not a big fan. It's really all to play for. I mean, at this stage, we haven't got a clue, to be honest.
OK, so in terms of who the UK is going to be sending to Brussels, we've got this new flock. I mean, the 29 Brexit Party politicians, including party chair Richard Tice.
We're comfortable with the WTO Brexit.
The former communist Claire Fox.
It's so exciting because, you know, 6 weeks ago this party didn't exist.
And Annunciata Rees-Mogg, sister of Jacob.
Let's leave the European Union as quickly and as cleanly as possible.
The former Tory MEP Anne Widdecombe.
And therefore it was incumbent upon me to play my part. Any old fool can score a century from the pavilion. Get out there, I said.
You've suggested that they might be irritating, but they can't actually make massive changes. I mean, we've also got all those Lib Dems who are pro-Remain, Labour MEPs, most of whom are pretty anti-Brexit, the Greens, including former Lord Mayor of Sheffield, Majid Majid.
I'm absolutely elated. In all honesty, this was not just a win for me, not just for some other people, for everyone who chose hope over hate. And
just tell me what happens when they arrive. I mean, what will they be doing?
Well, I mean, they've got quite a sort of learning process to get through. Very few of them will know much about the European Parliament and how it works at all. They won't know how to do the electronic voting. They won't necessarily have their offices straight away because this long, complicated process of actually the parties deciding which groups they're in has to be completed. When they do have the groups, they'll get their offices in Brussels, and they'll learn that their life is an awful lot of travelling between their constituencies and Brussels. And when they come to Brussels, they won't see much of Brussels. They'll be stuck in some pretty airless rooms in the ghastly European Parliament buildings.
And so many of them are going there driven by this Brexit vote on either side of the argument. I mean, what will they hope to achieve?
In terms of the Brexit Party, I suspect it'll be just like UKIP. What they hope to achieve is to make an awful lot of noise in these big plenary sessions, that's when the whole chamber's there.
You have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk.
And the whole chamber there is there generally kind of, for example, when a prime minister comes to speak, maybe they'll heckle the Macron sort of figure.
Do they actually heckle world leaders?
Oh, crikey. Yeah. Lots of shouting. I mean, it's notable that it's particularly the UKIP lot shouting and screaming. Yeah, more than anybody else.
And apparently they'll earn £45,000 by October. I mean, do you think a part of them secretly doesn't want us to leave?
Well, I don't want to cast any aspersions on Dan Hannan, but he was crying in a small clip he did from his garden last week, saying, I do not want to be elected. This is not what I want to happen, but vote for me so I can make sure Brexit happens.
The only reason that I'm standing for election tomorrow is because I want to make sure that Brexit happens.
Well,
and I want it to happen.
He's been returned. I'm sure that 45 grand will be quite helpful.
Oh, my heart bleeds for Dan Hannan, one of the few Tories who will have to go back to Brussels. And what about all these pro-Remainers?
Well, they'll want to get down to business. I mean, the danger is that we'd sort of driven out on the 31st of October and that lot would have sat for a few weeks and don't have anything to do. And then they're out and they've earned a bit of cash, but they've not been able to do any good for Britain or for the European Union.
Dan, is it right to extrapolate these results into what they might mean for a second referendum?
No, I don't think you can do that. How do we analyse the Conservative vote or even the Labour vote? It's much more nuanced. It's not Remain or Leave necessarily.
I mean, people say it's a protest vote. It's not the same in a general election. But this election is going to influence how the Conservatives and Labour behave. I mean, the former Tory MP Nick Bowles tweeted, "This will turn the Tories into a party of no-deal Brexit." I mean, do you think that is certain to happen?
Yeah, I do think, actually. I think that the big losers last night were the likes of Matt Hancock, who were kind of, look, we need to compromise, we need to get this deal through, but look, I'm young and full of hope and I've got all these great policies. I think those candidates are in for a bit of a shock. I don't think he's got any chance whatsoever. I think the candidates who, the Raabs and the Boris Johnson of this world, who say that it's either we're out on the 31st of October, no matter what. Conservatives are going to try, I suppose, to out-Brexit Nigel Farage, which is a rather impossible thing to do, but they kind of have to. And what else can they do?
Although the timing is interesting, because by October the 31st, the new European Commission won't even be in place. I mean, presumably things are quite quiet in Brussels over August. If we're going to leave on the 31st of October, there's not really time for a renegotiation, is there?
There is nothing to renegotiate. The withdrawal agreement is done. The only thing that can possibly renegotiate is a political declaration. So it doesn't matter how much Dominic Raab says it's renegotiate on the backstop or it's out, no deal on the 31st of October. He's just saying we're out on the 31st of October without a deal, is what he's saying, because there is no negotiation to be had.
And it's been really tense for Labour. I mean, it feels a bit like a civil war. We had Shadow Foreign Secretary Emily Thornberry saying the lesson was to stop triangulating and to offer a referendum in all circumstances.
The most important issue was what was our view on leaving the European Union, and we were not clear about it. We were not clear on the one single thing that people wanted to hear.
Paul Mason on the left of the party attacked Corbyn's closest advisor for trying to straddle the divide. He said the party has to come out Remain. But then MPs in working class seats feel really differently. Gloria De Piero wrote a plea in The Guardian not to desert Labour's long-held coalition of voters over this single issue. This is really difficult for Labour, isn't it?
It is an impossible decision, but the fact is they've got to adapt, and they've got to adapt really very quickly, and they're going to have to listen to their membership, probably, because the membership is essentially going to force them to change their position. 80% of their membership want them to be a full-on blooded Remain party. It's not working sitting on the fence. They're going to have to make a choice. What sort of party are they? I don't think really there's that much of a choice to be had, because Labour are not going to back Brexit. It's just not going to happen. Look at the vast swathes of their membership. It can't happen. They're going to have to be true to themselves, it would seem to me.
And so Jeremy Corbyn has said that there's going to be a consultation with members and that a final decision will be made in September. I mean, isn't one of the weird things about this that the narrative that you're talking about there, the idea that the Tories need to swing behind a harder Brexit or they're finished, or that Labour needs to swing behind a tougher Remain position or they're finished, is quite an easy one to take when we look at the changing political landscape in the UK, more divided down this Remain-Leave axis. But it's incredibly complicated, because for many decades, these parties have had coalitions of voters that have crossed that divide. I mean, the suggestion, therefore, would be that the Tories just give up on that kind of liberal swathe of its voters, and that Labour gives up on many of the white working classes across the north that may have voted for Nigel Farage.
This is an earthquake, and everything has been thrown up in the air, and it's going to come crashing down with a completely different look. But that's what's going to happen. There doesn't seem to be any way out of this. The first pass of the post system has created these two parties with this large, you know, very broad spectrum, both parties. But it's not going to work anymore. The divisions are too deep. This Remain-Leave division is the big division. And I'm afraid that is going to work its way through in terms of political parties now.
I mean, there has been this kind of earthquake, as you say, not just in the UK, but across much of the continent. But there's also been this real difficulty that Britain has faced in terms of extricating itself from the EU after so many years entwined with its systems. Is the rest of Europe looking at this and thinking we have now persuaded all the other countries not to go for a similar strategy?
Pretty much all the populist surge parties, you know, the parties that were thought were going to do well and were thought would be really awkward, they've moved from saying we want France out, or we want the Netherlands out, we want Italy out, to we want to change Europe within. And Brexit has played a very large part in changing minds in these parties, because they've seen what a mess, and they've seen the humiliation of the United Kingdom, and they don't fancy that much at all.
So, Dan, it was a long night for you. You were awake for most of it, I presume.
All of it.
Sitting in your hemicycle, watching the Eurovision results stream in. Obviously, you took a great interest in the UK result. But overall, what was the takeaway from the night?
The centre, while shrunk, had held. And the pro-European parties still retain a big enough majority and a way forward to prevent the likes of the Brexit Party and the other populists from stymieing the European project. But, you know, this time, there's going to be a big slog over the next 5 years to make sure that in 5 years' time they keep these parties away. Because if you look at the likes of Matteo Salvini, he's got 35% of the vote. It's huge. And it's unprecedented. And he's knocking on the door. So in 5 years' time, there could be trouble.
Daniel Boffey, please go get some sleep. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
That was Daniel Boffey. Do follow all his reporting and that of his Brussels colleague, Jennifer Rankin, as well as our Westminster team for the latest developments in politics, including, of course, Brexit. Now, I just want to thank everyone who has rated Today in Focus on their podcast app. We really appreciate it. And do leave us a review if you get a chance. Coming up, the robots that could take over fruit picking jobs on farms. Now, The Guardian and Observer financial reporter Julia Kaliwa has been finding out about RoboCrop, the world's first raspberry picking robot, and its implications for the world of work.
Today I went along to a Hall Hunter farm near Chichester. Hall Hunter is one of the biggest berry growers in the UK. They supply Tesco, M&S and Waitrose with strawberries, blackberries, raspberries and blueberries. They are developing a robot with Fieldwork Robotics, which is a spin-out from the University of Plymouth, to pick raspberries. At the moment it's just one robotic arm, which is attached to a big metal frame that runs on wheels. It's about 1.8 meters tall. The robotic arm has got sensors and 3D cameras. It zooms in on ripe fruit, and the gripper can soften or stiffen. It uses machine learning, which is a form of artificial intelligence, then picks the raspberry in 10 seconds or less and drops it in a tray. And there the fruit gets sorted by maturity, and the berries are then moved into punnets and trays and are then ready to be transported to supermarkets. It was just really weird seeing this arm move all of a sudden and zoom in on a raspberry and then pick it. It was just a bit sci-fi. Eventually, the final robot version will actually have four grippers, not just one, which will cover the whole raspberry bush. So all four arms will be picking raspberries simultaneously. It takes about 10 seconds or less for one of those arms to pick a raspberry. And they've calculated that one of these robots with four arms will be able to pick more than 25,000 raspberries in a day. The robots obviously won't get tired, and they can pick for 20 hours a day and into the night. The farmers are hugely excited about this. They've got other growers knocking on their doors, actually, who are interested in this robot, because labour is actually one of the biggest costs for fruit producers. Labour makes up half their costs, and obviously the minimum wage has been going up, and so farms actually have started poaching pickers from other farms, and they're having to pay more to attract people. So anything that will reduce their costs is just hugely welcome, and this robot can do that. I talked to the British Summer Fruits trade body, and they said last year fruit growers were 20% short of seasonal pickers, and that it's a real struggle for them. And berry and apple growers have been hardest hit by the decline in the number of people coming from Eastern Europe. So robots will obviously help raise productivity, which is important in the UK, where productivity growth has been lagging behind other countries. But it obviously also raises the specter of job losses. An academic paper, she found that increased use of industrial robots raised productivity, but did not significantly reduce overall employment. It did reduce employment share made up by low-skilled workers, but several people I talked to said that if robots become more common, you will need a new cohort of highly skilled workers to maintain and debug the machines. So it will also create new jobs, but different kinds of jobs. I think in the future, say 10 years from now, we'll see a lot of the fruit and veg in this country being picked by robots, just simply because the UK isn't alone, it's not just Brexit. The rest of Western Europe, the US and China are all struggling to recruit enough seasonal workers and fruit pickers to pick their crops. And that's simply because people are moving to cities. They'd rather work in a hotel than slave on their hands and knees picking strawberries or raspberries.
That was Julia Kaliwa. You can read her piece online. My thanks to her and to Daniel Boffey. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.